It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, the right advice at the right time. If you'd like to call in, 247-7282. And Cecil Harvell is here with us. Hi, Cecil.
Good morning, Ben. How are you?
Along with another associate here.
Yes, Sam Morris here is with us this morning.
Good morning, Sam. You've been on the show here once before anyway, right?
I have, yes. So, yep.
All right, so what are we talking about today?
Sam, what are we going to talk about today?
You know, I think that today would be a good time to talk about the kind of the nuts and bolt of appellate practice. And some of our listeners might not be too familiar with that term and what exactly it means, but I want to kind of set the stage up from a perspective that we, you know, that they might know a little bit more about. So, you know, throughout the years here, Cecil and Wes have talked about trial courts in North Carolina, litigating in trial courts.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe we start off by like imagining a hypothetical. Imagine that a case is just proceeded through Superior Court here in Beaufort, North Carolina, or any other of the county courthouses throughout the state. And during the course of that trial, maybe something arose that, you know, one of the lawyers thinks was improper. For example, maybe evidence was admitted that shouldn't have been admitted.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe an attorney made an improper closing argument. Maybe the trial court applied the wrong standard of review, these types of things during the case when it was proceeding there, for example, in Beaufort or mm-hmm. in Washington or in Wake County or mm-hmm. wherever. And so what happens after that? Well, ordinarily after the trial, what will happen is that the parties that feel that the case should be reviewed further, that this error might should be corrected, or that this legal principle should be changed or reasoned through or something like that, will file what we call an appeal. And that is essentially a process whereby a party will challenge a lower court ruling formally by appealing it, sending it up to a court with authority to reverse that lower court.
Yeah, I think a lot of people kind of in those of us in the great unwashed, we always think of, oh, we're going to appeal
our cause is just and we are going there.
Yeah. It doesn't always happen that way.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, oftentimes we don't really know much about our court system in general, but our appellate courts especially. But, I mean, you know, whenever we have, like, as I said, I think last time I was here, a Supreme Court nominee come up or you hear a big case from the Supreme Court, you know, people kind of their ears might get perked up a little bit more mm-hmm. about what those courts exactly do. But so I think going back to that, there's a few procedural points that people need to know about. And that is when you're going through a trial and the trial is over and you've got, let's say, a judgment in your hand against a person and mm-hmm. you feel like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to go collect on this judgment. Well, guess what? There is this process for filing an appeal. Ordinarily, after the trial is over with, you will have 30 days to file your notice of appeal with the Court of Appeals, and that applies to most types of cases that are going to be held in Superior Court or District Court around here.
Now, does that notice of appeal have to state all the reasons of the appeal, or you have to state
what's going to happen? Exactly. So I think that one thing that you have to remember, and this is something that we at Harvell & Collins, I know Wes and I, whenever we're talking about cases that are proceeding through the trial court, you have to really start, and it is critical that you don't start planning your appeal after you lose a case.
Mm-hmm.
You have to anticipate all of the various issues that might come up on appeal should you need to appeal. So throughout the case, you're making challenges in the trial court. The first step, so to your point, Ben, mm-hmm. is that during the trial court, you have to make objections to evidence that shouldn't come in. You have to object to arguments that are improper. You have to make a formal objection if the judge, for example, uses the incorrect standard of review in reviewing mm-hmm. something. And so with those, if you fail to do that, you normally can't challenge those on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
That's called those issues are then deemed waived or mm-hmm. abandoned for appeal. So after the trial, though, you're right. You're going to file your notice of appeal with the Court of Appeals, and you're going to basically briefly state the issues which are going to be there on appeal. Now, after you've done that, there's a process that any lawyer that's ever had to pursue an appeal as the appellant, the person seeking review, they have to go through the process of settling the record. What that is essentially, you know, you have to wonder, how are these judges that are sitting in Raleigh at the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court able to review what the lower court did? They weren't there to hear the witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
they weren't there in the courtroom to see the, you know, the party's demeanors.
It's not going to be re-argued before them.
Exactly. It's not going to be re-argued, so to speak. So the way that they review the case is by reviewing what's called the record on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And so the attorney seeking the appeal after, you know, during this time period has to propose or provide what's called a proposed record on appeal. And mm-hmm. that's normally going to include all of the relevant documents at the trial court level, such as, for example, the complaint that's been that was filed, the answer that was filed, discovery information that's relevant to the appeal, anything that's relevant to the, addressing the immediate issues.
But
on appeal.
But it needs to be narrowed to those issues. On
it
appeal.
Does, yeah. I mean, you generally have to include some provisional documents, like basically statements of jurisdiction for the mm-hmm. trial court, but ordinarily, the documents that you're going to provide in the record on appeal are going to be targeted to the issues on appeal.
I think there's some cases are there that are argued de novo. I mean, they can start over on appeal.
Well, well,
and from the clerk's office, I believe. So
well, that's a bit different, but that's a good point. From the clerk of court's decisions, there are certain and from the magistrate court,
right. mm-hmm.
there are certain statutes, if you will, Ben, that allow there to be a de novo or all new trial
right.
hearing at the next level. This is and the next level for the clerk, of course, would be, you know, the superior court
yeah.
of that county.
Mm-hmm. So but generally what we're talking about is beyond the superior court.
We are. And there is no de novo at this level.
Right.
Because our courts of appeals and our Supreme Courts do not sit as trial courts,
mm-hmm.
okay? They only sit as appellate review of the law or errors mm-hmm. of law. They are not fact finders, which is what happens at a superior court level. Let's pause for just a minute and talk about the fact that what we are speaking of, Ben, is state
mm-hmm.
law right now.
Right, right.
We keep using this word, the Supreme Court, and our listeners might be thinking, you know, the Supreme Court with
the nine
you
in
know
DC.
Our
yeah.
new Judge yeah. Kavanaugh
right.
or Ruth
right.
Bader Ginsburg or whoever the justice might be, mm-hmm. Justice Roberts. That's the United States Supreme Court. We are not speaking about federal law right now.
Yeah.
We're talking about state of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about cases that have been heard in the Craven County Superior Court, Onslow Superior Court, Beaufort, Carteret
mm-hmm.
County Superior Court. And now the lawyers feel that there was an error during that trial
right. mm-hmm.
in some manner. They objected during the trial, and now it's being bumped up for review to the North Carolina Court of Appeals or the North Carolina Supreme Court.
Yeah, and Sam, most of these cases are would end at the state Supreme Court anyway. I mean, if they involve state issues, they're not constitutional issues.
Right, yeah. I mean, oftentimes when it comes to state law, the North Carolina Supreme Court's pretty much the final say-so mm-hmm. on that.
Okay, I want to back up a little bit because you talked about making those objections during the original trial. I'm going to imagine that's a bit of a dance because you have to, you know, instead you can't object to everything.
Right, you can't object to everything, but you do. You have to, you know, and this is where, you know, a seasoned litigator
yeah.
who's fully prepared for trial. This is why you want one at the trial court level, because at some point in time you might deem it not to be in your strategic strategic best interest to object to something.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this witness is going to be particularly, you know, unhelpful to the other side, so you want to let them keep on talking.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you want this piece of evidence to come, something like that. You might not want to always object to it. But the critical thing is that if you think that this is something that could be detrimental to your case and you have a basis to keep it out,
mm-hmm.
you need to object to it, because if you don't, you can't challenge that as being improperly admitted at the Court of Appeals, for example. Because, I mean, the basic rationale about it for the Court of Appeals is that, well, if the lawyer who was in there didn't think it was bad enough, why should we?
Yeah, well, yeah,
you know,
there you
that's
go,
kind
right.
of the practical aspects of it. But, yeah, that's why with the trial preparation phase of things, everything is so important, because you have to be able to anticipate these types
mm-hmm.
of things. And you're generally going to be able to do so once you've had your discovery process and whatnot, like Wes has talked about on here before.
Now, you've talked about going through all the different evidence that applies to the appeal, or the different documents
mm-hmm.
and everything goes. Now, is that heard before the entire appeals court? Is it just a single justice hears that first, or
right. well,
the process?
It depends on what level of review you're at.
Mm-hmm.
from most North Carolina cases, cases that our listeners will probably be most familiar with, they're going to go directly to the Court of Appeals following a trial at the Superior Court.
Okay.
That's going to be heard by a three-judge panel at the Court of Appeals. They sit together. Not all cases, though, that go up for on direct appeal to the Court of Appeals have oral argument.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the parties just submit what we call briefs, and every party will submit a brief, but sometimes the judges decide the cases simply on the briefs without oral argument. These are going to be types of cases where the law is very, you know, pretty much settled on the matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really anything that nuanced or anything that they feel like they really require oral argument on. And if the briefs clearly lay out exactly what happened, and also if the parties don't request oral argument, judges will just read the briefs and make their decision based on that.
And I guess they're looking for something that is incorrect on its face then, and just, it's
right,
just it's
right.
going to be obvious.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that kind of leads us to an important segue with regards to what kind of review is the Court of Appeals doing, because as Cecil mentioned, the judges on the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court are not reweighing evidence.
Mm-hmm.
They're not reweighing the facts. They can't substitute the trial court's judgment for their own there. But when it comes to issues of law, there is a de novo review process for issues of law,
mm-hmm.
which maybe, you know, we can discuss the difference between them in a minute.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with more here on Let's Talk Legal. If you have a question, you can call us right now. Kenzie will take that call.
That I will at 252-247-7282.
Hey, welcome back here. Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. And thanks for joining us here today here on Coastal Daybreak on Let's Talk Legal. We have Sam Morris joining us, Cecil Harvell, as we're talking about the Court of Appeals. Now, where do we leave off there, Sam?
Ben, I think we left off talking about the difference between the standards of review that apply on an appeal.
Right.
So ordinarily, like Cecil was saying earlier, the Court of Appeals judges and the Supreme Court justices don't reweigh the facts. They don't retry the case or anything like that before
mm-hmm.
them. But they do have the authority to review issues of law de novo. And so what does that mean? Well, I mean, a lot of our listeners might be familiar with back in their, you know, sixth or seventh grade civics class regarding Marbury versus Madison and the
right.
court's ability to interpret law and whatnot. And it kind of goes back to that. But the idea is that issues of law, the judges can substitute their judgment for the trial court judge's judgment and determine
mm-hmm.
what exactly is legally required for a certain, holding to come out. So, for example, whether, you know, the search of a defendant's cell phone after their arrest,
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, an unreasonable search under the Fourth Amendment? Those types of legal questions. Now, they can't go and say, you know, Sally Jones hit John Jones with her car, running through the red light, contrary to what the jury found. They
mm-hmm.
can't reweigh the evidence.
Yeah, right.
But they can interpret the standard of review in a way that, you know, it could change the outcome of a case.
The applicability of the law that was
exactly.
That was used
mm-hmm.
in a conviction, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So you could have those types of, you know, sometimes those distinctions can be kind of fine, but they can end up changing, you know, the standard of review that they use could end up ultimately changing the outcome of a
mm-hmm.
case.
Well, we've seen the use of RICO, racketeering laws, actually now kind of in other areas. And so that has come up often for review because whether or not that applying that law was actually appropriate.
Right. Yeah. And that's just one of the functions of appellate courts in general. I mean, it doesn't just apply to the criminal side of things. It applies
mm-hmm.
to, when does the time frame for filing an elective share begin? When does the time frame for
mm-hmm.
Suing your contractor for, improper workmanship on your home? You know, what kind of claims can you bring? All that kind of all those issues eventually are going to be or have been decided by the appellate courts when it comes to these sort of outcome determinative issues.
Well, we've talked about that before, just even with the reworking of the power of attorney, that some of the, at some point in time, some of those issues may come up, may need a court decision to clarify what the legislature said.
Yeah, absolutely. Unless you think that the legislature is always emphatically clear with the way they word something.
Yeah, you would hope.
Yeah. And which is not the case. I mean, they do the best that they can do, and you know, you can't foresee all these sorts of circumstances that can arise, but that's the way litigation happens. Mm-hmm. And you have, you know, in the adversarial system, you're going to have lawyers making strong arguments on both sides to show why maybe a law should or should not apply.
Mm-hmm.
And based upon those arguments and in that adversarial context, that's what frames up the issues for the court to say, does the law apply this way? Does mm-hmm. it apply that way? And so that's what their function is. It's their, you know, going back to that Marbury versus Madison idea, it's those judges' job to say what the law is.
Mm. Correct. Mm. So Ben, let's talk about this from a practical perspective. The power of attorney is a good one. Our new North Carolina Power of Attorney Act, which was effective January 1 of this year, we're coming up almost a year that we've been operating under this new Power of Attorney Act. One of the provisions of that act is that if a bank does not release the funds pursuant to the Power of Attorney or mm-hmm. give sufficient reasons therefore in some way, shape, or form, a banking institution, then they can be held liable.
Mm-hmm.
So let's assume that Mr. Jones goes in and is operating under Power of Attorney for his brother, and that for some reason the bank or banking institution does not honor the power of attorney.
Right.
And does not, for whatever reason, honor the timelines that are stated forth in the Power of Attorney Act. Well, Mr. Jones then sues the banking institution, and that case is going to go to Beaufort, to the North Carolina Superior Court.
Right.
Okay, in Beaufort or New Bern or Wilmington, wherever the case might be.
Mm-hmm.
The judge then is going to have to make a decision as to whether or not the banking institution factually, mm-hmm. From a fact standpoint, did the proper kind of communication, notices back to Mr. Jones as to why they were not honoring the power of attorney. But during the course of this trial in the Superior Courtroom, one of the banking witnesses, do you need to take a break?
No, we have a call.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well,
right. Go ahead, finish your thought.
Yeah. One of the banking witnesses makes some statement about the fact that so-and-so told me that she did it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that usually is hearsay evidence, and for whatever reason, the judge allows that information into the trial,
right,
and
right.
the jurors hear that,
mm-hmm.
and then they make a ruling.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of thing that then would be objected to at trial,
mm-hmm.
could possibly be error mm-hmm. that the Court of Appeals then would review.
That's a great example. Yeah. All right, let's get Russ in New Bern, and he has a question for us. Hi, Russ. How are you?
Good morning, everyone.
Hey.
I had a quick question about real estate law. Is this mm-hmm. a good time?
Sure.
Okay. What are the pitfalls for a seller who is selling one of the flooded houses as is, where is, hold harmless?
Mm-hmm. Can you sell a damaged house as is, basically?
You absolutely can. It just would need to be, I would suggest that the seller document and over-document and then document a little bit more that these are the terms of the sale.
Mm-hmm.
That it is absolutely an as-is agreement, that the buyer has been advised
mm-hmm.
of and is willingly taking on this property, notwithstanding the fact that it was a flooded property, that the seller makes no representations as to you know, whether the repair works could be adequate. I mean, those kinds of things. I
mm-hmm.
would suggest that there be a paragraph or two of just real clear language. And then at that point, I don't know of any problem with the seller conveying. Do you, Sam?
No, and I think that, you know, obviously your residential disclosure agreement and statements and, you know, the various documents you're going to have through the contracting process, you're going to want to disclose everything that you know to be wrong with the property from the storm. So these types of things are just going to be things that you're going to want to proceed in good faith and make sure that you communicate to the buyer and don't hide anything for sure.
Yeah.
You want to disclose everything.
All in good faith. Right?
All in good faith. And but, yeah, you can sell your property.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So on the contract, I guess, as you're going down all those check boxes, the best mm-hmm. thing to do is just hit no representation on the things that you don't know.
True, but also Those are pre-printed forms, and mm-hmm. they're just wonderful. But something like this should be added as an exhibit that both parties sign. Something like this should be a dictated paragraph or two in addition to the pre-printed form, mm-hmm. dated and initialed by both parties at the time of contracting. Because this is beyond that the scope of the pre-printed form.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
And that brings up a fantastic point over, don't rely, this is for our audience in general, don't rely on pre-printed forms to cover all of your various needs, because guess what? This pre-printed form was not designed with Hurricane Florence in mind.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Russ. We'll have more to come in a moment here, and if you'd like to call in too, 247-7282, and we'll have more with Let's Talk Legal. And we're back with Cecil Harvell and also Sam Morris here as well, too, sitting in, as Wes would normally sit in that chair. Yeah. And we're talking about the appellate process.
Well, we've just got a minute or two, but I want to pause and go off topic here for a second. I want our listeners to know Sam a bit better. Sam is a homegrown local guy, mm-hmm. and went to Croatan High School. How about mm-hmm. that? Did
right.
so very well. Went on to college, of course, then went on to law school, clerked for the North Carolina Supreme Court, and now is back in Carteret County with his family.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Sam, it's just a real pleasure to have you here. He is mighty busy, that is.
Yeah. Well, Sam, I have a question about that. When, you know, we hear about clerks for the U.S. Supreme Court assigned to an individual justice. Is it that way on the state Supreme Court?
It is. It is.
So who would you clerk for?
I clerk for Justice Paul Newby.
Okay.
He's the senior associate justice there at the court, and each justice is allocated essentially two law clerks to assist them with preparing for oral arguments and drafting opinions and going through various petitions for discretionary review and preparing for conferences. So the system is very similar to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
State law clerks get paid a little less, but that's just the nature of it. So,
Well, hey, I know in radio when you first produce and you wrote a commercial and you hear it on the air, you know, you're real proud of that. Do you hear when you know that your argument is the one that prevails?
A certain
amount of pride in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it was an interesting process just because you get to learn so much about state law generally. It's such a broad area that the Supreme Court gets to discuss and rule on. And it's one of those things where the cases that I worked on, they definitely, you know, they hold a special place in my heart after working on them for so long and whatnot. So it's mm-hmm. it's always good to reflect on that stuff. So
yeah. And of course, Ben, what any law clerk would bring to the practice of law, you know, is a heightened sense of awareness as to, you know, how to research certain issues mm-hmm. in the law, how to write certain letters or briefs or issues with motions with regard to the law. And these are, you know, everyday occurrences in our law firm. I mean, I had a lady just yesterday who came in whose husband had a certain issue at a nursing home, and she wanted to know what her rights might be as the spouse of her husband, who can no longer mm-hmm. really represent himself, as to those issues. And I told her we would research those and get back to her. And so research is a critical part of what we lawyers do.
Make an appointment at 726-9050, harvellandcollins.com.